So I'd like to start with a few comments about the Sangha in Israel, because it's just so interesting. Israel is a small country and a difficult country with conflict and getting worse, and yet a beautiful country with extraordinary people. The Israel Sangha that I started, and I'm the senior teacher there of the Israel Insight Society, it has 45 retreats in the year, with 2,000 people sitting in retreats, all on Dana. And many, many young people, soldiers from the army, students come and join. And then we have a lot of activities out in the community. I was just telling Margaret, we have groups in more than half the prisons in the country. We have work with the elderly. We have work with cancer patients. And we have peace programs with Israelis and Palestinians. And we go out to the Palestinian territories and help the Palestinians harvest their olives in safety. So we're out there as well in a very active way as the Dharma community. But we are very much a Dharma community, and a very strong practice, and really thousands and thousands of people. So it's extraordinary in a small country how big it is. So one small a story which can illustrate this. So about 2 years ago, I wrote a book, and it came out in Hebrew, and it was called Daily Life Awakening. And it's really about a view of awakening, how that view can radically change our life situations, how we see sickness, how we see work, how we see tiredness, how we see conflict, how we see memory, thought. And it goes quite far, in the sense that it's a book of practice, but a book of daily life practice. But it goes into what is awakening and how awakening is something that we can actually touch. And it goes into quite a high, it goes all the way, starting very simply. So I thought, well, it's just for the few Dharma students. It was 18 weeks number one bestseller in the country, in the non-fiction. 18 weeks number one. And it shows that it's not that this me here cares about the me. What it shows is the hunger and the need for Dharma, with thousands of young people who really need focus, who are living with anxiety, who are living with a loss of meaning. And I got invited to pubs, by the way, and bars after that, which is really strange, and all packed. And I started a whole program called Buddha in the Bar. And I went around 30 pubs and bars in Israel. And people with, you know, have the beers on the table, and meditating in the whole pub, quiet, the 100 people meditating. I have videos of this, you wouldn't believe it. So I'm just telling you all of this just to show a kind of the dynamic nature of the Dharma in a place like Israel, just to kind of give you the perspective that in every country in the Western world, the Dharma has arrived in its own culture, according to the culture. And so out there, that's the way it's arrived. And by the way, the book is translated, the book is now in English, and that's the reason I'm running around America. And you can have copies at the end. I'll say a word about that at the end of the evening. But it's now out in English under the title, What's Beyond Mindfulness? Waking Up to This Precious Life. And I'm teaching at Spirit Rock a couple of times, doing a one-day event. On Saturday, you're welcome. And it's on the issue of conflict, because we've had a lot of experience working with Dharma tools in the front line situation of conflict with Israelis and Palestinians. How do the Dharma work there in the real test? Anyway, but you have the front line here as well. It's not that it's not out, just out there. I know that the society here is as, you know, conflictive And our daily life can be full of conflict. So, actually, what I wanted to do tonight is not actually talk about conflict, except passively a little bit, but what's interesting to me is what's beyond mindfulness. Because we have it quite easily, we can feel, well, mindfulness has become so popular and strong as that language has in a way taken over the Dharma in the Western world. But it's worth remembering that mindfulness is the gate, but what's the garden? And the garden is the Dharma. And sometimes mindfulness can be a technique, but what about liberation? Beyond technique completely. And I really like the way the Satipatthana Sutta, I don't know if you know the Satipatthana Sutta, but it's the main sutta, which is the foundation of mindfulness, the four bases of mindfulness. It is the main sutta which is guiding the mindfulness movement. But if you read the Satipatthana Sutta and you go according to that, the fourth foundation of mindfulness is Dharma, and it's about mindfulness of Dharma. And it's not technique, because Dharma there is defined as qualities of being, like qualities of calmness, of investigation, of love, effort and energy, of joy. So the Dharma is the qualities that we bring. What sort of personality do we have? How do we get up from meditation? When we get up from meditation, what's happened to us? That's much more Dharma. Who are we? Did we change? Did something? And where is the change? That's really where the Dharma, where we're moving from mindfulness to the Dharma. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the fourth foundation of mindfulness is Dharma. And it has, for example, the seven factors of awakening. And the Four Noble Truths. And these are not concepts. The Dharma is a lived practice. It's alive. The Four Noble Truths is our experience now, in the moment, with a thought, a feeling, a sensation that has some dukkha in it, some difficulty, and then we let it go, and then there's some space that opens up, and then we're on the path. And all of that is the Four Noble Truths in one moment. So the Dharma is not concepts. The Dharma is right in the minute. How are we? And that, in a way, is kind of mindfulness goes there, but it's way beyond mindfulness. So I want to talk about actually equanimity tonight. And the reason is that we need it. We're living in a really difficult time. The world has never been so full of anxiety and stress and confusion, and people have lost their way. Of course, we see it in Israel, and I mentioned the young people there who are looking for meaning, but we're not talking about just Tel Aviv, we're talking about San Jose or London. And so equanimity is a really important quality in the Dharma, which is certainly, in a way, beyond mindfulness, but in one of the qualities that our whole Dharma life will help us develop. Not just mindfulness, but the whole Dharma life, everything we're doing in the way of our spiritual life will bring a little bit of equanimity to our life. So it's bigger than mindfulness, and it's an example. And one of the issues that we have to face is our vulnerability. We are vulnerable. In the end, there is no safety, and we can really feel that. There's a very nice Buddhist poem from the Theravada world that says, human life is like a seed balanced on a needle. Which is, whoa, really? Oh no, I don't want to be a seed balanced on a needle. But yes, the Buddha said it's very important to point that out, that there really isn't any safety that we can rely on. And so, we need to find an inner protection in this world. So, our usual response to vulnerability is outer protection. And the outer protection is, well, if I have a nice house, and if the water heater works, and if I have some money in the bank, and if I have a job, and if the family are not fighting each other like crazy, and if I have friends, and I have connection, and I have sangha, you know, sewing up, protecting ourselves outside. So our usual response to insecurity is an external armor. I'm okay if this doesn't happen, I have to control that. I have to make sure that doesn't disturb, and that doesn't disturb, and that doesn't disturb. And that's our usual way of doing things. But it's a big cost, because then all our life we're trying to control things. We're trying to control our body. We're trying to be healthy all the time, have money, have this, have comfort, have a nice house, have this. All our life we are busy coping and controlling. And equanimity goes somewhere else, which is not reducing the disturbance, but reducing our tendency to be disturbed. That means reducing disturbability, you could say, that things can happen to us, but our protection is inside and not outside, that we're trying to sew up a safe world. The protection is inside. And it's a different movement. It comes in our basic practice of three characteristics, anicca, anatta, dukkha. If we keep practicing, slowly, slowly, equanimity happens by itself. Because, just like in the instruction I was giving earlier, if we learn to hold a pleasant and unpleasant experience with balance in the laboratory of a meditation session, which is like a laboratory where we explore comfort and discomfort. And we hold both. And we allow both. And yes, this my back is hurting, or yes, but my hands are not hurting. And one thing arises and another thing arises, and I'm bigger than all of that. So that way we learn equanimity by ordinary practice of the three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, anatta. We see the way things change, we see dukkha, and we see ourselves being less central in everything, being less me and mine. And from there, naturally, equanimity will grow. And it's invisible, and it's inside. And it's really important. The Buddha's last words, more or less before he died, were, be an island to yourself. And the image that he was trying to express by that image is, in the Pali language, viveka, meaning independence. Stand your ground. Be autonomous. Be steady. Don't get swept away Don't get swept away by society, by others, by temptations, by needs, by issues, by protection, by safety. Don't get swept away. Stand your ground. Stand in your truth. That's what the image, and after that he explained to the monks that stand your ground, meaning be an island, is actually know your truth. Here's the body, here's the feelings, here's the mind, I am with that, that's my truth, and that's giving me equanimity and steadiness. So it's an important quality. So I have an example of equanimity in my own life, which I'll share with you. So, a little while back, I've got loads of grandchildren, and two of them were fighting like hell. And we were sitting, three of us, on a couch. So the two kids, they were 6 and 8 years old, more or less, and me. We were sitting together like that on a couch. I was looking after them. And they were screaming at each other like crazy, fighting. And every scream and every shout, I felt it here in the tummy, as just a little kind of zip of energy, because there's a lot of energy in the shouts. So I felt the energy here, biologically, did nothing, didn't go anywhere. I didn't feel disturbed by that. I decided just to be equanimous, just decided, and see what happened. And so I was, nothing really. It didn't work, the shouts. I didn't have to stop them, I didn't have to fight them, I didn't have to worry about them, nothing. But after a few minutes, because of, I think, equanimity, I could turn to them and say, don't you think it's enough? And they said, yes, actually. I have another story of equanimity, which is also a personal story. We did a lot of work with Israelis and Palestinians. We did peace work. And we had groups. We brought Israelis over to the Palestinian territories. And we were working together for 2 days, staying in Palestinian homes. And we did a workshop together nearly every month. Equanimity was behind the scenes in, although this was not, the people were not meditators or anything, you know, ordinary Israelis and ordinary Palestinians, but they, there was a sense of, I would say, balance and steadiness that we were developing over the weekend. The main peacemaking activity was the second day, when an Israeli and a Palestinian would be sitting together for 1 hour in couples and really listening, talking and listening about their life, and especially about the suffering of their life. And when they shared their personal pain in this way, both Israelis and Palestinians, essentially peace was made. Because no longer can this person be seen as a Palestinian terrorist, a Palestinian enemy, or the Israeli a soldier, an occupier, and so on. It's just a human being struggling to go to university, or with kids, or trying to make ends meet, or trying to work out how to live. And so that this human dimension really allowed people to go into each other's shoes. But equanimity was part of that, because we encourage people to be steady and to feel their sense of balance. Anyway, one day, the whole thing blew up. It usually was really fine, and people felt safe. But one day, they all started to scream at each other. And I was a facilitator with a Palestinian facilitator. And I lost it. I didn't know what to do. So Israelis and Palestinians screaming at each other. I took my chair. I took a chair like this. I sat right in the middle of the room and just sat there, waiting for it to finish. After 5 minutes, indeed, it settled down. I turned to the Palestinian facilitator, Rauda, and said, sorry, I blew it. I couldn't hold it. I screwed up, I'm sorry. She said, no, no, you didn't. You don't realize. Your equanimity, sitting in the middle of the, made them all settle down after 5 minutes. They would have been killing each other the whole day. I didn't even notice, but something must have emanated. The Buddha said, if you can, if you have talk with somebody who doesn't have strong emotions and doesn't have strong views, but is different from you, has different ideas, it's okay, it's not so difficult if they don't have strong views or strong emotions. If they have strong views but not strong emotions, or they have strong emotions but not strong views, you can still talk to them, but it's not so easy. It's a struggle. But if they have strong views and strong emotions, forget it. It's a sutta. It's a Buddhist text. However, the final bottom line of this text is never underestimate the power of equanimity. That means our steadiness influences others. It's a model for others. But everyone needs a model. And if everyone's in panic and anxiety and worry and concern, our equanimous presence can make change to people on an entirely non-verbal level. We did peace walks in Israel as well. Quiet, steady peace walks, Israelis, Palestinians, walking through towns and villages, quietly, in a line, not talking, but emanating steadiness, peacefulness, and heart, and metta. And it was very impressive. You know, the TV was really picked up on it. The police that were with us all the time, they were peaceful as well. And it worked. Of course, there's no peace in the Middle East, never mind all what we did. But that's something else. That's about measuring. We don't measure. And we don't, you can't afford to measure and judge and criticize. Oh, I do this, but it's not going to do anything. Oh, yeah, it's helpless. It doesn't work. It's not going to do anything. You can't afford to go to that place. That's measuring. All you can do is do what you can do and give to the world what you can. And the world will have to look after it. The world will have to do itself. You can't. You're not God. So, equanimity is being in the heart of disturbance. It's not denying disturbance. It's being right in the center of things. There's an English expression that says, when the pot boils over, don't leave the kitchen. Means being right there in the middle of things, you have to not escape, but be balanced and equanimous and steady in the middle of things. And it is important that equanimity is not mistaken for indifference. So it's quite easy to make that mistake. So we can feel sometimes in the Dharma, in the Buddhist world, yeah, I mean, I'm quiet and calm, I'm very equanimous. As long as, you know, the neighbor TV just not disturbing my meditation, or as long as, you know, I'm quiet and calm and very equanimous. And it's equanimity is not indifference. The non-stick, you know, it's not non-stick frying pan. The experiences that roll off. We really need, it's not water off a duck's back. We get wet. We need to be in the heart of issues and be right there and feel the pain of ourselves and others. But equanimity is where it doesn't really work inside us. And that's the difference. And we can feel that. And I think some of us maybe don't even notice, but it is happening when we go into difficult situations and something in us says, yes, I can handle this. Yes, I feel the pain of others, but I can be steady in the middle of that. Yes, it's possible. And maybe a few years ago before we were practicing, we would have been knocked over by events, that were by disturbances. One time I was in America in a retreat many years ago with Surya Das, and we were in a center somewhere in the States, I don't know where. And next to the meditation hall, one day, a huge bulldozer began to dig right outside the window of the meditation center. And it made a huge noise. The whole meditation, the hall was shaking. So someone asked the teacher, the Lama, Tibetan Lama, the Buddha said you can get awakened from the rustling of leaves. Can you also get awakened from the roar of a bulldozer? And the Tibetan teacher was sort of thought about it for a minute and said, actually, yes. Actually, yes. You can. So, the core central movement of equanimity is to be less full of ourselves. The self is built as a mechanism of protection. That's what the self is. It's a mechanism. It's like the operating system of the computer. That's what the self is. So the self is busy protecting itself. Someone shouts at you, and the self jumps up and says, how can you say that? That's defensiveness. If there's less self, you might find you don't need to say anything, because the person hasn't done anything to you. You are the one that's disturbed. But the person, in its daily life, someone, our boss at work, come and say, you're useless. The self, defending itself, will feel, oh, Lord, I can't sleep at night. Look, he thinks about me. It's good. It will be disturbed. But if there's less self, say, I am what I am. Here I am. I am what I am. And so the best example and the best story about equanimity, which gives a sense of a relationship between equanimity and anatta, or non-self or less selfing, is the story of the empty boat. It's a Zen story. So one day a passenger wanted to cross the river. So he went to the edge of the bank of the river, and there was a boatman there. And he said, and the boatman said, yeah, I'll take you across. So they started off, crossed the river. And after a little while, another boat came and knocked their boat. And the boatman shouted, stupid people, look where you're going. He shouted at the other boatman. And they went on. And after another 10 meters, another boat came and knocked them. And there wasn't any, this was empty, this boat. So the boatman didn't shout. And the passenger said, you shouted at the previous one. Why don't you shout at this one? And the boatman said, well, there's no one to shout at. If we understand equanimity in us is when we no one to shout at in here. That we are empty, there's nobody to shout at us. We have to be absorbing the shout and working with it for someone to disturb us. And if we are not disturbable because we're more empty, there's nobody to shout at. We will not suffer. We will not be protected. We will not be in automatic reactivity with everything that happens. And we will not be pressured to all the time fix things and sort things and protect things. We will just feel, you know, I had to practice it, as I was saying just earlier when we were having dinner together. When I arrived in the States just over a week ago, nearly 10 days ago, I arrived sick. And, difficult flight, 18 hours journey, and I was mostly with a fever, and I came here and I had to kind of teach sanghas, and I was still sick, and I had coughing and a fever and everything, and I went round to teaching anyway. And I really thought, well, the only thing that's driving the show, that's this thing, this show, is equanimity. If I was a person, more of a person, I was, oh, I can't do this. This is impossible. How did I find myself here? How can I possibly do this thing? Impossible. But somehow or other, the space inside us can really carry us through difficult situations. And we do have it because we meditate. And we're in the Dharma. And some of us here, I guess, are in the Dharma for years. And we need to acknowledge this space. And in the end, it's quite a big view. Equanimity is the highest of all the qualities in the Dharma. It's the seventh of the factors of awakening. It's the tenth of the paramis. And it's the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, the immeasurable heart movements. So I won't go into the lists. It's not so important. Those of you who know them, you know them, and if you don't, it doesn't matter. But equanimity is always the highest. And I think the reason is that if you're less of a self being disturbed by this, by that, and having an armor to defend yourself against life, then you're much more connected to life. And then you and life are basically one thing. The world and you are together, which is interbeing, which is interconnectedness, which is the basis of the whole Dharma. The basis of awakening is interconnectedness. So you and the world become one thing. And then who's going to hurt who? Where is the hurt happening? If you and the world are, in a way, merging. And that's why it is a final stage in the Dharma. But what I'm saying to you and us right here is it's not only a final stage. It's something the Buddha said, be an island to yourself. It's also the beginning. And we need it because life, especially today, is full of stress and anxiety and more than ever before. So we need it at the beginning, and it's certainly a quality that grows and grows and grows all the way through our practice. A final word, and I'm happy to have one or two questions. The Buddha said equanimity is like gold. It's like a goldsmith making things out of gold, meaning it's workable. And in the sutta, the Buddha said, equanimity is like gold. You heat it, you cool it, you sprinkle water on it. It's flexible. It's raw material for everything. You can make out of it a necklace or a ring or jewelry. But it's very pure. But it's very flexible. You can make out of it anything. So your equanimity can carry you more or less in any place. And in any experience, all experiences become equanimous. Every experience becomes part of equanimity, part of a journey to awakening. So here is an example, anyway, of something, which, a movement in the soul, which is deep dharma, and which is in a way, way beyond mindfulness. So I think that's all I'll say formally right now, but I'm very happy to have some dialogue. If anyone want to bring anything up, happily. Comments, questions, experiences, gladly. And by the way, I have to say, I remember being here 8 years ago. I remember this room, same place. I don't know how many of you were there 8 years ago, but I remember being here. I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, I wasn't here 8 years ago, but I'm glad I'm here today.
Good.
pretty amazing what you've been able to do in Israel. Because I'm sure there's, you know, a lot of tension there because, you know, they're constantly under a lot of pressure.
Yes.
For you to go there and bring calm to a maybe not calm situation is pretty impressive. Thank you for being a, you call it an ambassador of peace.
Thank you. Yeah.
I guess I'm new to meditating, and it has helped me identify less with myself, and you know, find less reasons to be offended. And you know, I used to think of it as an ego, and trying to figure out how to deal with that voice inside your head that's constantly looking for reasons to be offended, or looking for you know, reasons to feel separate from everything. And I guess I would ask, what practices do you recommend to truly feel like you're more connected to everything, you know, at one, you know, with the universe, rather than, you know, I guess how do you continue that?
So I think that there's no substitute for some really deep practice, and I really recommend all of you to go on retreat, because the intensity of meditation practice is really important here, because in the intensity of the silence you can really, really come to grips with those voices in you that give trouble, me, my defense, what you were saying. I think you're absolutely right what you were saying, but it just needs more intensity. And secondly, the big view can really help us. So if you're in a situation where you're challenged, or in ordinary situations in life, keep opening the view so that, for example, it's not just you and the rest of the world. Someone argues with you, go into their shoes, look behind their eyes. What is their, what's their presence? Where do they come from? What's their inner world? Why are, maybe they're doing something or arguing with you because stuff happening to them. So you'll go out, not just to inner world, but go to the outer world, look at out as well in the big view. See the way things are changing because of causes and conditions. Something happens and then there's a result. Someone feels bad and then they say something to you. So that helps you to kind of always be in the big picture, to not to be in a small picture, but a big picture. And another place for equanimity is the heart. So keep expanding your heart connection with the world. Say your kid's crying, you do something. The neighbor's kid's crying, You just want to throw stuff, you know, shut up, leave me alone. The last thing you want is the neighbor's kid to cry. But there's a kid. And so the heart would say, yes, okay, there's a child there in pain, rather than the neighbor's kids are disturbing me. It's always expanding the boundaries of the heart. So you're to the people you meet, the people in the supermarket, the people in the street, just keep expanding the boundary of heart and feeling the others and feeling people as they bump into each other, and really questioning the automatic behaviors that we have. Someone cuts us off on the freeway. We have two choices. We can be a reactive self. How can they do that? Beep, 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 you know, maniac. Or, oh, someone's gone there. What's the big deal? And go to the second place. Allow things to be unexpected. Allow things to be not what you expect. And so all of it, there's some of the ways. But deep practice. Okay, even not a retreat, but at home, really take your corner and take deep, deep quiet every day and watch what's happening in our inner world. And it works. It works.
Thank you.
Okay.
Could I add something to that? I was on retreat, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. The leader of the retreat was a Zen Roshi, and he stressed the deep value of silence. Not playing music, not being concerned you've got to listen to the bird calls and all that, not whispering to somebody and thinking that you're really helping the silence. Silence.
Yeah.
He said it is so powerful when we spend time in it because we have so little of it around us normally.
Yeah.
And I have another question. This may be confessional, but I'm still going to ask the question. Sometimes I find it easier to be equanimous around strangers or even people in jail than my own husband. And I don't always understand the dynamics of that. And I'm not proud of myself for that. And I don't exactly know how to get a bigger picture and how to escape from the whatever it is that's going on.
Well, firstly, I don't think you need to feel not proud of yourself, because I think it's important that we understand that close family relations is totally under the skin. It is not something that we can, in our mind, can't manage. Our mind can't sort that out. The close relationships, family relationships, couple relationships are so powerful, so unconscious, so deep, that we really have to respect that the ordinary mind is not able to kind of rationally work it all out. And so we need to understand the power of that happens in close relationships and realize that it's working under the surface all the time. And that we are not capable of really, kind of, we want to make things better, but it's too powerful very often. It's too close. We can deal with out there, but this is too close. It's right inside. So first thing is to be a little more sympathetic about ourselves. We can be practicing Dharma for years, but the family relations can be big time problem. Because Dharma teachers as well, you'd be amazed that the Dharma teachers have been practicing 30 years and then they go home and that, even Jack Kornfield was writing about it in his book, you know, after 10 years in the monastery, came home and met his mother and he was like, disaster. But I think that what's needed in close family relations that are problematic is to actually see the intimacy and the closeness as an opportunity and not as a problem, realizing that there is our limits. Our partners show us ourselves in the mirror. We will be seeing things that we don't like about ourselves, and we have to, in a way, be grateful for that. Not to expect another person to be in our control, but to keep finding, I mean, I know this sounds a bit idealistic, but every human being is an ocean, is huge. And if we can feel our relationship with somebody else is in this ocean, is not on the wave, boom, 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 but underneath, then it doesn't matter. We can be, and that really, equanimity really helps. Yes, they can say, you know, I love Trump, it's okay. Let them say. It's all right. They can say what they like. But we connect with in the ocean, under the ocean, in the depths. And that's where the connection really happens. And to really focus on that all the time. I have all the time people coming with relationship issues. And it needs focusing on the depth and then letting the daily life waves just pass by, not taking them too seriously and not letting them hit us because of emptiness here. To be more empty and just loving and not feel we failed. Because it's really powerful stuff. So it's 9 o'clock. I just want to say something about my book here. I'd love you to be able to buy the book if you want, just so I don't have to carry the books with me all over the place. The cover price of the book is $15. There is a box there that's written $15, but I don't care exactly if you put 15 or you put less. I'm not worried about the money so much, but I'd be really delighted not to have to carry the books around with me everywhere. The book is, as I say, is just come out, and it really is a guide from the beginning to the end, from ordinary daily life situations through practice, some of the questions. In fact, let me read. If I can take 2 minutes. It's 9 o'clock. It's all right. Take a minute. Okay. I just want to read to you a little piece from the book, because for me, it's sort of... and there's chapters. So you can just read chapters. A chapter on emotion, working with emotions. A chapter on war and conflict. A chapter on, yeah, there are chapters on it, just about everything, on karma. But it's just a piece that I think expresses the whole Dharma for me in one paragraph. So I just want to share that paragraph with you as a kind of a hint of what the book is like. And it's a little personal because it starts... I live alongside lots of olive trees, which have an amazingly expressive character that clearly shows everything that has happened to them. If a branch has been cut, or if the tree reaches out in a certain direction, or lumps are formed on the trunk, you can see it. The shaping of the tree is its memory, its sankhara, its response to conditions. And the tree doesn't have a problem with that. And there is no reason why we should have a problem either. We are also just shaped, constructed by life. We are given a body, and it develops and changes dynamically according to conditions. And we arrive in each moment as we are. And the world arises and meets us as it is. And all we need to do is to appreciate it and let it be. Stories are just stories. Narratives are just narratives. And embodiment is just embodiment. If we let go into this flow of life, The wounds will dissolve. The scars will be softened. And we will find ourselves in the garden of the now instead of the prison of yesterday's. A difficult experience can come up, just like an unpleasant visitor arriving in our house. We can cry, and the next minute we can laugh, and then he's gone. That's a little piece from the book. So, also there's leaflets there about online teaching that I've just started. I've opened an online Dharma school, which is deep Dharma practice. It's about deep Dharma. It's not beginner Dharma, but it's on like a whole course on self and non-self, on paticca samuppada, on the paramis. So I have courses on Dharma themes. And there are some leaflets also in my workshop at Spirit Rock on Saturday on conflict with Donald. So there's some leaflets there. And so they're all at the back there behind you on the shelf, the books, the leaflets, etc. And you're really welcome.
And I just want to add one little business thing that you mentioned. If people would like the book, you can pay for the book on your website using PayPal.
Possible, yeah. If anyone doesn't have cash, I can't take checks because I don't have an American bank account or card. But if anyone doesn't have any cash and they want to do it through PayPal, just take the little leaflet. I'll give you the leaflet. You come to me and I'll give you the leaflet. I'll show you where my website is. There's a donate button on the website. You can just do it there.